Good day. Today is Sunday, 29th March 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this video, you decide that you like what you've heard and wish to indicate that fact. Now, to return to a topic I discussed in a programme a few days ago, I'm sorry to say that the channel that I was talking about, the one that uses a false version of my identity, is still up there and continues to attract views. Many people have complained about the fact of its existence. I've had many reports about it. We on the Duran have done so as well. I have no doubt that it will be taken down in due course. In the meantime, all I can say is please remember that it has absolutely nothing to do with me. In fact, I find the whole topic of channels of this kind distressing. Channels that use my identity to sell themselves in the way that this one is doing. I have no doubt that in time it will be taken down. And please remember again what I have said in the past. The only channels where it is the real me, where it is I myself who am providing the commentary that I do, is this one, the Duran, and one or two other very well-known channels which I sometimes appear as a guest upon. Anyway, that is all I'm going to say about this topic. I want to accept, of course, to thank all of those who are writing to me with expressions of concern about this. The matter, I am aware of it. We at the Duran are aware of it. We are doing something, what we can, about it. We do believe it will be eventually resolved. In the meantime, well, I've said, I think, all that I can, except to wish everybody who has written to me on this unhappy subject, to wish them all a great thank you. Now, let's turn to the topics of today's programme. And again, I'm going to start with the situation in the Middle East. And the situation in the Middle East continues to be the same as always. The Strait of Hormuz remains closed. There's been constant commentary, lots of reporting, many discussions by various individuals around the world, including the President of the United States, that Iran is relaxing its control of the Strait of Hormuz. It's allowing more ships laden with oil and other products to cross, to exit it. The President of the United States spoke about 20 Pakistan-flagged vessels being allowed by Iran to exit through the Strait of Hormuz. I've seen no evidence to support the last claim. And for the record, my own understanding is that the reality is, if anything, the opposite. That over the last couple of days, the Iranians have actually tightened control of the Strait of Hormuz. They're allowing fewer ships to pass rather than more of them. So that is what I am actually hearing. We will see what happens in global markets when they open properly tomorrow. But for the moment, the Iranians retain control of the Strait of Hormuz. They show no sign of relaxing or loosening their control. And, well, the problems that the closure, or rather the control of the Strait of Hormuz have been causing, the steep reductions in the availability of oil and of the many other products that are exported through the Persian Gulf, well, all of those problems continue and continue to get worse. Meanwhile, the war goes on. And it's important to talk about the war, because I've also noticed that over the last couple of days, the talk about negotiations between the United States and Iran, talk that originated entirely from the United States, talk which basically was focused on comments that were made by the President of the United States himself. Anyway, all of that talk seems to have abated. In fact, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Mr. Ghalibaf, has now come out and said that Iran doesn't really believe that the United States is interested in negotiations at all, that all of the talk of negotiations is a distraction, that the real objective of the United States is to conduct a ground operation of some kind against Iran over the course of the next few weeks, and that the talk of negotiations is intended to lull the Iranians into a false sense of security, to fool them into thinking that the United States is de-escalating, even as it is in fact escalating, and the Iranians are not going to fall for it. And the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, and by the way, other Iranian officials on the topic of some kind of ground operation against Iran by the United States, they are all saying one and the same thing. Bring it on. Iran is ready. Iran will defend itself. Iran will fight and fight these American troops wherever it is that they're sent. And, well, Iran is not going to be intimidated. It is not going to be frightened by all of this talk of ground operations into negotiations, that Iran is confident that it can withstand this American blow. Now, it may be that all of these brave words coming from Iran are just that, brave words. Maybe the Iranians are bluffing. Maybe when they say that they are fully capable of meeting head-on any ground operation that takes place and inflicting severe losses and damage on American ground troops, maybe all of that is just bluff, it's just empty rhetoric. Perhaps it should not be taken seriously. However, I have to point this out. If that is so, then it is not consistent with what has happened throughout this war. The Iranians have repeatedly, for the last 2 years, been saying that they have the capability to defend themselves if anyone attacks them. They have repeatedly pointed to their drone capabilities and their missile capabilities. They have repeatedly said that they can strike American bases and radar stations across the Middle East. They said before the attack on the 28th of February that if there was an attack upon them, they would attack those American bases and those facilities across the Middle East. The Iranians said that they held open the possibility that they would tighten and, in effect, close the Strait of Hormuz if they were attacked. And they also gave warnings to the various Arab states of the Persian Gulf, and, by the way, to Israel as well, that any attack upon them would meet a vigorous, powerful response by Iran using its missiles and its drones. And, well, many people before the 28th of February, I read many articles saying as much, claimed that this is all bluff, claimed that the Iranians, all of these threats the Iranians were making were just empty air, the usual bluster, that kind of thing, that these threats should not be taken seriously, and that almost certainly that misplaced confidence that the Iranians would not be able to act on their threats. Undoubtedly, in fact, unquestionably played its role in causing the attack on Iran that took place on the 28th of February, with wide assumptions that Iran would not be able to respond with force, that China would prevent Iran from closing the Strait of Hormuz, that if the Strait of Hormuz did close, the effect on the global economy would not be that great, that most of Iran's missiles had already been depleted as a result of the attacks that took place in June of last year, that Iran's drones were ineffective and could not do much in the way of damage, that the Iranian government, that the political system was fragile and weak and ready to collapse like a house of cards. And of course, what turned out was that every single warning, every single threat, if you prefer, that the Iranians made came true. And it turned out that they weren't bluffing after all. And well, here we are in the situation we are in today, 4 weeks on. The fighting continues. There's no sign of any early resolution, and Iran continues to keep the Strait of Hormuz and continues to hit back. So, I personally, given this record, the fact that the Iranians have repeatedly fulfilled their warnings, I would not assume. I think it would be entirely reckless to assume that when they say that they will respond and respond vigorously and successfully to a US ground operation, I personally think it would be utterly reckless to believe that any of that is empty words or some kind of bluff. Now, whether that is well understood in Washington, in the Pentagon, in CENTCOM, the US command that basically appears to be operating this American campaign, or in Israel, or amongst the Persian Gulf states, I don't know. But I would have thought that by now, it ought to be obvious that Iranian warnings are not empty, that they should be taken very seriously. Now, I say that because we've had a further article in the Washington Post that talks about ground operations being prepared by the United States. And, well, we're not told the exact size or number or of the forces involved, but the Washington Post says that a plan does exist, some kind of plan has been cobbled together to conduct some kind of ground operation against Iran. It says that it will not be a full-scale ground offensive against Iran. The US military and political leadership understand that given the size of the country, the size of its population, Iran's resources, a conquest of Iran is beyond the existing capabilities in the region of the United States. It would require all-out war by the United States to achieve an objective as grandiose as that, and the United States lacks the political will and the political interest to fulfill that kind of objective. So instead, supposedly, we're going to have raids, we're going to have attacks on islands, perhaps Harg Island, perhaps other islands in the Strait of Hormuz, perhaps other facilities deeper inside Iran. And this is going to be done by special forces and light troops, presumably the men of the 82nd Airborne Division and the Marines in the area and the various special forces units being deployed to the area, as Larry Johnson on Sonar 21 has pointed out. But that apparently now is the plan. Now, on this, I've had some thoughts from a friend of mine who has a lot more information about this kind of thing than I do. When I say information, a lot more expertise about this sort of thing than I do. He has had, shall we say, a background involving the military, to be specific, the US military. I don't think I can say more. Anyway, he speculates that the most logical target for an operation of that kind would indeed be some of these islands in the Strait of Hormuz. He says that they could be used potentially for bargaining with Iran to try to get Iran to relax its hold on the Strait of Hormuz. That doesn't seem to make much political or strategic sense to me, as I will discuss in a moment. But he also says that one of the advantages of seizing control of these islands is that some of them at least do have airstrips, and that ought to make it possible to keep any American troops in these islands supplied, if only by air. And the fact that some kind of military operation, some kind of ground operation of the kind discussed by the Washington Post is indeed being planned and prepared is a letter circulated to members of the US Marine Corps, specifically those who are being sent to the Persian Gulf area, written by the Lieutenant General in overall charge of the US Marine Corps. And well, if you read it, to me at least, you can find the full text on Larry Johnson's Sonar 21 blog, Naked Capitalism. Eve Smith in Naked Capitalism publishes it as well. Well, if you read it, to me, it clearly anticipates that the US Marines are indeed going to be sent into action, ground action, against Iranian forces, and that this is being done in full anticipation of casualties. The letter seems to envisage the actual possibility of casualties. Now, again, I am not an expert in these matters. I must defer to those who are. I have already said that based on my own limited understanding, this looks like a very high risk operation indeed. And yes, I do accept that airstrips might in theory provide some means to supply troops on these islands if they're captured. And yes, I also accept that these airstrips could be used in extremis to evacuate any troops who are there who get into trouble. The problem is that Iran, as it has demonstrated, does still have a functioning air defense capability. It may not be present everywhere across the whole territory of Iran, but Iran clearly does have still air defense missiles and air defense radars, and might be able to interfere to engage any supply aircraft. But also, and beyond that, Iran has missiles and drones, and they could target these airstrips. And I wonder whether, if that were to happen, it would be possible to send supplies into those islands using those airstrips, or to evacuate or remove US forces from there if the need to do that arose. And of course, there's always the speculations that in these kind of operations, which might last several weeks, the United States would try to protect the forces on the islands by attacking the Iranian positions on the mainland, from which the drones and the missiles and the air defense missiles and the radars were being operated. But then we come back to that Financial Times article, which spoke a couple of days ago about how the risk of operations of this kind is that, in fact, instead of strengthening overall the US military position against Iran, what it would do is tie up US resources in trying to defend the troops who found themselves on those islands. And that could actually overall reduce US offensive capabilities against Iran and might, of course, expose American aircraft, American personnel, American ships maybe, to further retaliatory action by the Iranians. And that the Iranians do have the ability to conduct counteractions, counterstrikes of a devastating nature, was demonstrated by footage, photographic footage, which is indisputably real. And it's backed by comments by all sorts of American commentators about an Iranian drone and missile strike on the big US base in Saudi Arabia, I believe near Riyadh. And, well, it does seem as if significant damage was done. Not only was a US refueling tanker apparently damaged, perhaps to the point of destruction, but an AWACS, early warning and control aircraft, was also caught on the runway. And, well, the photographs I have seen suggest that this important and expensive aircraft was essentially destroyed. Now, the United States has lots of refueling tankers and has lots of AWACS aircraft. When there were reports about a year ago of Russian A-50 AWACS aircraft being shot down over the Ukrainian battlefields, the point that was made, and it was a valid point, is that Russia has only a limited number of these aircraft. Some said fewer than 10. Well, the United States has multiples more of these, and of course it can replace these losses. But the fact is that these valuable aircraft were caught on the base and were destroyed by the Iranians. So Iranian drones and Iranian missiles were able to penetrate and attack what might have been assumed to be a heavily defended airfield in Saudi Arabia. And that, of course, brings us back to the fact that so far the United States has not succeeded in establishing effective defences against Iranian drones and Iranian missiles. There's been many revelations about the limited numbers of air defence interceptors in the possession of the United States, the difficulty some of these interceptors have in shooting down Iranian missiles. Professor Postol says that these missiles, the TADs and the Patriots, actually do not have the ability to shoot down ballistic missiles, that all the claims that they do are phony and bogus. And to repeat again, he is somebody who is perhaps better able to talk about this than almost anyone else I know who is commenting about it. because designing ballistic missiles was his job. So it given that the Iranians were able to inflict this level of damage on valuable American aircraft on a base like the one in Saudi Arabia, how much more likely is it that they would do even more damage to any resupply aircraft trying to send take supplies to American troops on these islands or to evacuate them from those islands? Speaking of the attack on the base in Saudi Arabia, I noticed incidentally that just as has happened in Russia following successful Iranian drone attacks on Russian air bases, that there is a great deal of hand-wringing and complaint in the United States amongst informed commentators about the fact that all of these aircraft were there exposed on the runways, that there is a shortage of hardened aircraft shelters on these in these bases, the bases that the United States established in the Persian Gulf area. There's questions about why those hardened shelters weren't created, just as there is, by the way, in Russia. I think in this case, perhaps the criticism is even more valid. The bases were located relatively close to the territory of Iran. Iran was known to have many missiles and many drones. Iran had demonstrated a capability to strike at these very same bases. The conflict with Iran has been brewing for many years. I would have thought it was a basic precaution to harden the bases in preparation for a conflict with Iran, which, well, as we on the Duran discussed many times, sooner or later was likely to happen. But it wasn't done, which is why all of these valuable aircraft were caught out in the open and have been damaged and destroyed. Again, there is so much about this whole operation that begs, this American operation that begs so many questions. Why things that one would have expected to be done were not done? Why there has been so many mistakes in planning, so many deficiencies in the preparation for this operation? It's clear that the problems extend far back beyond the current administration, which is not to give the current administration any kind of pass, by the way. But anyway, there it is. Now, Vladimir Zelensky has been saying, the Ukrainians have been saying, that the reason for the successful Iranian strike against this American base in Saudi Arabia was that the Iranians were given information about the presence of American aircraft at this base by the Russians based on data the Russians were obtaining from their satellites. And of course, this is the Ukrainians. And well, that isn't in any way a reliable source, just to say. The Iranians obviously have an incentive to talk up Russian assistance to Iran. And of course, the Russians are doing their usual game of making what might be called weak denials, which don't seem to be specially convincing. And the Iranians, for their part, are saying very little. Now, all I will say is I have looked at the footage of the damaged American aircraft, and it does seem to me as if the strikes on these aircraft were very precise. In other words, the Iranians knew, didn't just know they were there, but knew exactly where on the base to find them. And it also suggests very high levels of precision, by the way, on the part of the Iranian missiles. Now, without underestimating again Iran's own tech capabilities, which do look to be very great indeed, I still, on balance, think that such an effective strike carried out with such a very high degree of precision requires competencies, technical competencies, which, because of resources, are simply beyond Iran's reach at the present time. So I would say that this attack, the success of this attack, does point to assistance being provided to Iran by one of the two great powers, China and Russia, which have made no secret over the course of this conflict that they are sympathetic to Iran and are backing Iran. Both China and Russia have partnership agreements with Iran. Iran is a member of the BRICS. And of course, there is also apparently, and it was just agreed a few weeks before the current conflict started, a tripartite agreement of some kind between Russia, Iran, and China, the details of which I don't know, but which was apparently agreed. Now, of those two great powers, as between Russia and China, my best guess is that the party which would have assisted Iran with this attack would indeed be Russia. The Russians have the capability, they have the incentive. They themselves have been attacked by the Ukrainians on many occasions, used with technical and intelligence assistance unquestionably provided by the United States. The Russians, as I've pointed out now in several programs, back in 2024, expressly warned that if missile strikes using Storm Shadow and Scalp and ATACMS missiles were carried out against the territory of their country, that they would respond by facilitating attacks on Western bases around the world. This attack on the base in Saudi Arabia fulfills exactly the terms of that Russian warning. And of course, there's been all those dribbles of information, many of which have been circulating in the British and American medias, in fact, the Western medias, over the last few weeks, which appear to originate with Western intelligence agencies. There's been this dribble of information backed from private emails that I have received that the Russians have indeed been providing intelligence and technical assistance to Iran. So, again, I will express my own opinion. I think that what Zelensky says and the Ukrainians say about Russian assistance to Iran to attack, carry out an attack like the one we've seen on the base in Saudi Arabia, that Ukrainian claim by itself is worthless. But because That is so. It doesn't mean that the Russians haven't played a role with this attack. And I think the overwhelming balance of evidence is that they did. And that brings me back to this question of the possible American ground operations that the Washington Post is talking about, and the operations to seize islands and to do things of that kind. Now, here I'm going to say again that I do consider that the United States does have very, very capable special forces, and I have no doubt at all about the training and the competence of units like the 82nd Airborne Division. I've received some pushback from some people when I say things like that about my belief in the competence and effectiveness of these US military units, but I stick to that. I've seen in enough places how effective they have been, and I have no doubt at all, personally, as to their effectiveness. However, it is also true that the United States has been very successful in conducting special forces operations, in part because the other side is not being provided with real-time intelligence on a continuous basis. So in Venezuela, in Iraq before, in Yugoslavia, against the various organizations that the United States has previously fought in the Middle East, the adversary has not been receiving a constant flow of very high-end intelligence from a great power backer. It seems that Iran is, in which case I would have thought that that calls into question the entire premise of the operations that were being discussed in that article in the Washington Post. If the Iranians are being told, as they almost certainly are, by the Russians, where the Marines are, where the 82nd Airborne Division troops are, where they're assembling, when they're moving, if the Russians are able to keep track of their communications, and I do understand that it's not easy sometimes to break into the other side's communications, and, well, all of that, but again, who knows exactly what the Russians, and the Chinese too, by the way, might be capable of. Then the Iranians are being briefed in advance about these kind of operations and will be prepared for them. At that point, or so it seems to me, they become especially risky and problematic. There was a really good piece that I read somewhere. I think it was on Unheard, the British centre-left magazine, that the United States and Israel are engaged today in a conflict completely different from all of the other conflicts in the Middle East, or indeed throughout the entire post-Cold War period that they have been fighting up to now. Obviously, Iran is a much bigger country than Iraq was, for example. The political system in Iran is completely different and far more deeply rooted than Saddam Hussein's regime was in Iraq. Not that Saddam Hussein did not have significant amount of support from Iraqi society, because he did. The other, however, important difference, and this is unique in terms of all the wars the United States has fought up to now, arguably since Vietnam, is that there is very good thing reason to believe that the adversary, in this case Iran, is getting intelligence and technical support from America's great power adversaries. This has happened for the first time, and it is one of the things that has decisively changed the calculus. It means that Iran can draw on resources that previous adversaries could not, and amongst those resources are real-time, continuous flow of very high-end intelligence. Now, again, I wonder whether this is properly understood or discussed in the United States, whether this has been pointed out to the president himself and his top officials. I sometimes wonder. But, or whether, if they are being told about it, whether they fully understand the implications. Anyway, for what it's worth, I mention it here. The Russians, from a Russian point of view, as I've said already, this is payback time. They know all about the help the US has been giving Ukraine. For the record, the United States has never officially, formally admitted the extent of the intelligence assistance it has provided to Ukraine. It has confirmed that it has provided a significant amount of assistance, but it's never provided a full account of the intelligence assistance it does provide, and we should not expect the Russians to do the same. Just saying. But anyway, but the Russians, it is payback time, and of course they're cashing in, and as I've discussed in many programs, this plays anyway to their ultimate geopolitical interests, as it does to China's too, and the Russians are far from oblivious to this. Anyway, that's the situation as of today, it seems to me, in the conflict in the Middle East. We hear less of diplomacy today. There are reports that the Saudi foreign minister is heading to Pakistan. He's supposed to be meeting the foreign ministers of Pakistan, Egypt, and Turkey, all in order to, as the Saudis are saying, try to find some way back from further escalation. I wonder whether the real purpose of this visit by the Saudi foreign minister is, on the contrary, to urge the Pakistanis to conduct some kind of ground operation against Iran themselves. That idea has been floating around. The Pakistanis, like the Kurds, don't seem to be very keen on doing this at all. And quite apart from anything else, they have to worry about what the reaction in India of such an operation would be. And of course, they also have an ongoing conflict with the Taliban across the border in Afghanistan. So I don't think the Pakistanis will be keen to do this at all. There may also be some discussions between the Saudis and the Pakistanis about the transfer of nuclear weapons technology, or even nuclear weapons, from Pakistan to Saudi Arabia. There were reports yesterday in the British media, which of course were completely uncorroborated, that there is no active discussion within Iran about Iran pulling out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, opening the way once the conflict with the United States and Israel has ended for Iran to move forward towards acquiring a nuclear weapon. But to repeat again, for the moment, this is purely in the area of rumour. I've seen no independent confirmation of anything like that from Iran itself, just saying. And well, to be frank, there's a lot of things going on, a lot of activity going on in Pakistan. But the Iranians, as I said, remain deeply suspicious of all calls for negotiation. They're saying that there are, in fact, no negotiations underway at all, that Iran is not interested in negotiations at this time, that it has set out its own conditions, which are indeed radical, and would represent a massive defeat and a geopolitical revolution in the Middle East if the United States ever conceded them. Anyway, so that's what the Iranians are saying. And as far as I can see, that's where we are. I don't get the sense there's any negotiations. I think the Iranian plan is to keep fighting a war of attrition, which the Iranians have every reason at the present time to believe that they are winning. And given the fact that they are receiving or appear to be receiving backing from one and probably two great powers, Russia and China, I don't see why they would feel under any serious pressure to change course. So that, it seems to me, is the reality. Meanwhile, at a regional level, things continue to go their way. The Houthis have conducted their second missile strike against Israel. A member of the community wrote to me, or to be more precise, this person wrote in a thread to my previous video that Iranian territory is located significantly closer to Israel than Yemeni territory is. I stand corrected. Mea culpa. I've never been good at reading maps, as I have often said. Anyway, there it is. But the Houthis have opened a further front against Israel. There is always the risk, the very real risk, in fact, I would say it's a high possibility, that if there is a ground operation, they will close the Red Sea, as they have done in the past, creating a further blockade in terms of oil exports for the Persian from the Persian Gulf area, which will presumably lead to further upward pressure on energy prices. And in the meantime, it does seem as if the US is beating some kind of retreat from Iraq, that there is indeed a complete pullout of Ukraine, of American forces from Iraq underway. And well, there continues to be intense fighting in southern Lebanon. The Hezbollah seems to be conducting strikes again inside northern Israel. Information about missile and drone strikes on Israel, both by Iran and Hezbollah and the Houthis, by the way, is very difficult to come by. The Israelis, for the record, are maintaining very, very tight control on this kind of information. But there are some concerning reports. There are reports that Hezbollah has also obtained possession of fiber optic drones. And well, it's possible that the Iranians and Hezbollah, having seen the success of Russian use of fiber optic drones in the Ukrainian conflict, have developed these drones themselves. But again, isn't it more logical to assume that the Russians, who have a close relationship with Iran, have provided the expertise to make these drones to the Iranians themselves and to themselves and have probably supplied a certain amount of these drones to Iran? And isn't it at least possible that the Iranians have copied these drones with Russian permission, just as the Russians copied the Shahed drones, the Iranian Shahed drones, and developed the Gerans? And isn't it possible and even likely that as Iran, with the backing of Russia, has developed this fiber optic technology over the last 10 months since the June 2025 war, that Iran has shared it with Hezbollah, and that this explains why Hezbollah is now able to operate fiber optic drones against the Israelis in southern Lebanon and in northern Israel? And well, there's been some reports about angry complaints from the mayors of Israeli cities in northern Israel about the attacks that are being conducted upon themselves. I believe these reports are true. And there are also claims, this time from Hezbollah, that using fiber optic drones and other weapons, Hezbollah has successfully destroyed seven Israeli Merkava tanks. Well, that may be true or it may not be true, but I don't know one way or the other, so I'm not going to say. But anyway, it does seem as if Israel is also now caught up in a war of attrition in against Hezbollah in Lebanon, and this is, of course, a further drain on Israeli and alliance. By alliance, I mean the alliance of the United States and Israel is a further drain on their resources. And well, the Israelis are apparently now worrying about the morale and the level of endurance of the IDF, which is based on citizen soldiers. It's not a professional army in the way that the US military is, for example. And apparently, there's tiredness, there's demoralization. Many units have been operating almost continuously ever since the 7th of October 2023, the event, the attack on Israel by Hamas, which was the starting point ultimately of this whole current iteration of the Middle East crisis. There's even claims, which I don't myself credit, that the IDF is on the brink of collapse. I don't think that things can possibly be that bad for the Israeli military. I think they still undoubtedly can keep operating. And in fact, they also seem to be engaging in Syria as well, where there were reports this morning that they'd captured a small town there. But anyway, there is a depletion of resources. There is a sense that the war is widening. And well, with every day that passes, it seems to me that the problems for the United States, for Israel, appear to mount. And when I say for the United States, obviously that is the main party to this war. Israel does not have the ability to engage Iran by itself. We are still at that stage in the war when the United States finds it impossible to negotiate with the Iranians based upon Iran's enormous demands. But unless there is a breakthrough, at some point, some kind of negotiation will have to take place, and the United States will at least need to address those Iranian demands, because there may be no alternative. Now, on that topic, I go back to what Dmitry Medvedev was saying in that comment that I discussed yesterday. He referenced the fact that it took the United States 10 years of fighting and very complex negotiations to exit the conflict in Vietnam, with the economic pressures caused by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, with the rapid depletion of American inventories, with the stresses on American troops. I've been reading, by the way, an astonishing piece in Responsible Statecraft about the USS Gerald Ford. It suggests a carrier that has never really resolved its many teething problems, that whose designers embraced complex new technologies, that offered little in terms of additional capabilities over and above what already existed, but which increased the costs and reduce the overall reliability of the systems. And, well, it looks as if the Ford is heading back to the United States for many months or even years of repair, with an exhausted and demoralized crew, and is going to be replaced by the George H.W. Bush. But the word also is that the crew of the Lincoln, the current carrier, is also becoming tired, and that it too may have to be taken out of the battle area as well. Anyway, with all of these pressures mounting, with the political pressures increasing in the United States, with the economic crisis that is developing, I do not believe that the United States has anything close to 10 years or 20 years, as was the case in the conflict in Afghanistan. I think that at some point over the next few months, we will start to see pressure within the United States grow, insisting upon some kind of talks with Iran to try and find a way out, and with more and more people in the United States backing concessions to Iran, however difficult those concessions might be. But we're not there yet. As I said, the talk is of escalation. If these attacks that the Washington Post was talking about, using these paratroopers and Marines and special forces, takes place, well, I hope I have outlined clearly what I believe the very real risks to be. If those operations go wrong, if many valuable soldiers are killed or captured, if some operation is seen to fail, well, the political damage in the United States is going to be considerable. That is going to affect even further the president's authority. And despite the inevitable calls for further escalation that you're likely to see from some people, I think that the mood in the United States will be to push harder for more negotiations, for talks, in order to find some kind of way towards a speedy exit. Now, in these discussions, I mentioned Vladimir Zelensky, and, well, he clearly is becoming increasingly worried about the whole situation. He's been on a tour of the Middle East. He's been visiting all the various Gulf states. He's been touting various defence agreements that he claims to have entered into with these states, whereby the Ukrainians supposedly are offering these states anti-drone technology, that the Ukrainians supposedly have this expertise that the Gulf states need. I have already in many programmes discussed how Ukrainian claims to have successfully intercepted most of the missiles and most of the drones that Russia routinely launches against Ukraine are obviously exaggerated and untrue to the point of, frankly, complete falsity. By the way, on that, yesterday Russia conducted another major drone strike across Ukraine, this time with about 400 Geran drones. No missiles apparently used this time. I get the sense that the Russians, seeing the depletion of Ukraine's air defences, are content to conduct many of their attacks now with drones, because they believe that most of them, contrary to what the Ukrainians are saying, most of their drones are getting through, and they don't want to expend valuable missiles unnecessarily when much cheaper Geran drones can do the job instead. Anyway, I was seeing film of Odessa in complete blackout, of explosions taking place at various points around the outskirts of the city, as presumably Geran drones were crashing and, you know, striking their targets and doing significant damage in that way. There's also apparently been attacks in all sorts of other places in Kiev itself. But anyway, notwithstanding all of that, Zelensky touts himself as the great salesman. He says Ukraine has this enormous expertise, this huge ability to resist and defeat drones. And he's coming around, traveling around the Middle East, telling the Persian Gulf leaders, who are, of course, by now in desperate straits, well, this is the technology that we offer you. There's been a very cruel, mocking video of Zelensky doing this, of him walking across a desert landscape as the drones and the missiles from Iran crash and explode all around him. And he's walking with his great anti-drone technology, which turns out to be a parasol, a beach umbrella. Anyway, I'm not going to. If you want to find this video, I found it quite hilarious. This is my own take. But anyway, this is what he's currently doing, and of course he's talking up, perhaps rightly this time, the level of Russian help for Iran. He still refuses to negotiate or to make any concessions, and at least concessions to the Russians to bring the war to an end. His attitude still is that Ukraine has been attacked, that it is a victim of aggression, that it is wrong and improper to put pressure on Ukraine to make concessions, even in conditions of global economic crisis, which is what we see, even in conditions of depleting American resources. He continues to demand ever more help for Ukraine. And he has been peddling this story, which he's been peddling now for months, that the Americans are refusing to give Ukraine a security guarantee unless the Ukrainians accept the Russian demand and pull out of Donbass. Now, finally, the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, came out and said that this is not just untrue, but straightforwardly a lie. Rubio says that the United States has never linked the question of the United States giving a security guarantee to Ukraine with the issue of a Ukrainian pullback from Donbass. What the Americans have been telling Zelensky and the Ukrainians, at least since Anchorage, is that the question of a security guarantee to Ukraine from the United States cannot even be put on the table unless and until the conflict in Ukraine has ended and there is finally peace there. And Rubio has explained it very simply. He said if the United States were to give a security guarantee such as the one that Zelensky is demanding, whilst the war in Ukraine is underway, then that would make the United States a direct military ally of Ukraine, and that in turn would mean that the United States would have to become involved in the war. So, if Ukraine were to pull out of Donbass, but the war were to continue, and it is important to understand that Russian demands are not limited to a Ukrainian pullback from Donbass. The Russians have set out their demands many times. They demand, for example, that Ukraine revert to neutral, non-aligned status, that it give up the idea of NATO membership, that it restores rights to Russian speakers on Ukrainian territory, that it takes actions, agrees to limit the size of its armed forces, that it does all sorts of other things, and that only once all of those things have been agreed, and there are some steps by Ukraine to implementing those things, only then will the war end. Well, Rubio is in effect saying that only once all of that happens, in other words, once Ukraine ends the war, settles with the Russians on what will of course be Russian terms on the basis of Istanbul Plus, only at that point can the issue of security guarantees for Ukraine by the United States even be considered. Now, I have to say that I think this has probably been the American position all along, going back to Anchorage. It's important and interesting that Rubio has now disclosed it. The administration has been holding it back ever since Anchorage, presumably so as not to inflame people in the United States like Lindsey Graham, and of course Zelensky's European friends. Now that there is this conflict in the Middle East with Iran and the attention is focused on that, Well, the Americans can now finally tell the truth. It's not just Donbass that is the issue. It is Ukraine's agreement to accept Russian terms to end the war. Obviously, a withdrawal from Donbass is a part of it, perhaps a very important part of it. Undoubtedly, it is. But it is not the whole of it. And the war is not just going to end because that happens. Ukraine must address all of the other Russian concerns as well. So anyway, clearly it has been Zelensky primarily who has been talking up this issue of a Ukrainian war retreat from Donbass, making it appear that this is the sticking point in the negotiations, presumably because he doesn't want to acknowledge or to get the Americans to acknowledge the sweeping extent of the concessions that the Americans made or pretended to make to the Russians in Anchorage. But we could see that Rubio has finally told us or provided us with the key to the truth. Now, the Russians have seen this, and we've had more comments from Ushakov, and Ushakov says that the Americans are coming up with all kinds of interesting ideas, but they so far have been unable to get the Ukrainians to act on those ideas. The Russians are clearly deeply skeptical about the whole negotiating process. I go further. I'd say that they have given up on the whole negotiating process. Putin supposedly asked, well, the Russians tell us that Putin asked Trump, can you actually really get Zelensky to agree to what we have agreed? In other words, Istanbul Plus. And Trump promised him in Anchorage that he could, and we've seen that in fact and in practice, Trump has not done so. So the Russians are saying it's obvious that the Americans are not going to fulfill what they promised in Anchorage. And this is true. The commentator known as Events in Ukraine has actually made that point. If the United States really wanted to put pressure on Ukraine to compel Ukraine to agree to whatever it was that Putin and Trump agreed with each other in Anchorage, then the United States has all the tools to do it. It can block all economic assistance to Ukraine, not just from the United States, but from Europe as well. It could obviously stop military transfers to Ukraine, weapons transfers to Ukraine. It can stop intelligence assistance as well. And the administration has done none of these things. But anyway, we can now see, we got a better sense now from this exchange, both of the degree to which the negotiations that we have been seeing over the last few months have been reported falsely, but perhaps more importantly, confirmation that they are ineffective deadlock, and the extent to which the United States, with a far more severe crisis to worry about in the Middle East, has basically lost patience with Vladimir Zelensky and is now prepared to come out openly and contradict what he says. Anyway, that's all interesting but and important in its way, but it is academic. More important is what is going on the battlefronts at the present time and what the progress of the war is. And, well, we've had more news, negative news, about Ukrainian offensives. The Ukrainians have, for example, over the course of their Zaporozhye offensive, regularly reported their capture or recapture of the village of Ternovata. In fact, many Ukrainians deny that Ternovata was ever captured by the Russians at all. Anyway, drone footage has appeared over the last 24 hours of a Ukrainian armoured force trying to break into Ternovata and being destroyed on the outskirts of that important village by the Russians. So the Russians control Ternovata and the Ukrainians have not recaptured it. There's all sorts of people who are trying to claim that the Russians have conducted some kind of successful counterattack and have recaptured Ternovata from the Ukrainians who previously had captured it back. I don't see why we need to engage in these complex theories. There is video footage also showing Russian troops in another village in the Zaporozhye area, the northern, northeastern Zaporozhye area, which the Ukrainians claim to have recaptured. And again, there were the usual speculations. Did the Ukrainians capture it, recapture it, as they said? Were the Russians driven out? Is this an isolated pocket of Russian troops who were left behind? Have the Russians conducted a successful counterattack? The explanation, as far as I'm concerned, is perfectly simple. The Russians have always been in control of this village from the moment they captured it. And again, all reports that the Ukrainians had recaptured it were simply wrong. And, well, in the Kupiansk area, a couple of days ago, there were more reports circulating that the Ukrainians supposedly had successfully recaptured all of the city of Kupiansk on the east bank of the, on the west bank of the Oskol River. And, well, a number of the mapping projects then adjusted their maps and showed, or purported to show, the whole of Kupiansk on the west bank of the Oskol River back under Ukrainian control. But again, over the last 24 hours, another video has appeared showing Ukrainians conducting drone strikes against Russian troops in central Kupiansk, west of the Oskol River. In other words, contradicting those earlier claims. And again, of course, we've had the usual bewilderment. Did the Russians come back? Is it a sabotage and reconnaissance unit? Is it a Russian unit, stragglers who were left behind as the Russians withdrew? Was there a successful Russian counterattack? The reality is, I am sure that the Russians were always there and remain in control. What I think there is little real doubt about is a claim that the Russians made yesterday, that their forces have captured a village called, it's a small town, called Kosharovka, south of Kupiansk, Uzlovoy, on the east bank of the Oskol River. Now, as I've said many times, I'm the worst person to read maps. But assuming that this Russian claim is true and it comes from the Ministry of Defence, which makes me think it almost certainly is true, then this must mean that the pocket of Ukrainian resistance, east of the Oskol River, the place where Gerasimov and the generals told Putin way back in the autumn that a Ukrainian force of around 5,000 men had been surrounded and placed in a cauldron, that this pocket has finally been squelched, that it's been crushed, and that Ukrainian resistance on the east bank of the Oskol River has finally ended. In which case, that does represent, or so it seems to me, well, maybe not the final end of the Battle of Kupiansk, but almost certainly the last stage towards the final end of the battle for the city and the territory of Kupiansk. It's been a very complicated battle in which the Ukrainians have heavily over-invested resources. Events in Ukraine points out also how heavy Ukrainian losses have been in this attempted counteroffensive that the Ukrainians conducted in northeastern Zaporozhye region. But anyway, it looks as if both of those battles are coming to an end as the spring thaw closes and as we see the first moves towards that big Russian offensive, which I expect, on the pattern of what happened in the last 2 years, will begin sometime in mid-April. Anyway, there we go. This is where I'm going to end the programme today. It does seem to me that the global focus has rightly shifted from Ukraine to this confrontation, this epic struggle between Iran, Israel and the United States in the Middle East. The global repercussions, economic repercussions of this conflict can hardly make it otherwise. But it's important to understand that the Iran conflict and the Ukraine conflict are intimately interconnected with each other. Two of the big adversaries, the United States and Russia, are involved in both. And neither for the moment seems to be going well for the United States. Anyway, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.